Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back, everybody, to our study of St. Theophan's
welcome
correspondence
to the Ancient Christian Writers
the Young
series,
Anastasia.
Led
and
by
we're
Father
moving right
David
along.
Abernathy
we're coming closer to the end
Pittsburgh
of the book now.
Oratory
out of 80 letters, we're on letter
Pittsburgh,
63, starting it this evening on page 251.
The following recording is a reading
of the text,
and discussion
following along.
Of the spiritual life
and,
by St. Theophan the
Recluse. If you remember,
recluse,
he had been talking to her about
our ability to provide podcasts free of charge
the spiritual
is made possible
life,
by the generosity of listeners like you.
Passions and so
if you would
not
like
just
to make
internal
a contribution
struggle with the
in support
that we
of our
have,
ministries,
or feelings and
please
desires
visit
that we have,
www.thepittsburghoratory.org.
Form and direct
your interest and prayerful
the feelings,
support
thoughts,
are
and desires toward God or towards
God
that
bless
which
you
is
and
holy.
Enjoy the podcast.
So things such as vigils, prayer, fasting. So all of the active practices of the ascetical life. He's moving on tonight in letter 63. We see him becoming a little bit more particular with her because she's asking him specific questions now about her own life and aspects that she has in her life and how the spiritual life is applied to them. And so tonight he'll be speaking with her a little bit about singing and music, which evidently was a pretty important part of her life. And so some of it might seem a little dated, certainly the music that he's encouraging her to play. It sounds like she was a pianist. And I think God loved the Tsar, God saved the Tsar was one of the things that he encouraged her to learn. And so maybe not applying to us directly. But I think nonetheless, it should be interesting for us tonight because music is a big part of our lives and certainly a big influence upon us from our youth, sometimes in very positive ways, but we also know sometimes in negative ways, certainly the way that our culture has been going over these last decades. And so what he says to her is certainly here pertinent, but trying to help her to look at the things of her day-to-day life and how they might be ordered to God, and some of the things that she might want to gravitate away from, specifically if she's finding that it's making her lose that sense of remembrance of God. They're not of a certain quality that lead to a kind of recollected state, but rather lead to distraction or dissipation. Okay. So don't be afraid to ask questions about this one. I think of all the ones that we've read, certainly tied more to the time in which it was written. So again, 251. I hurried to bring our discussion of the struggle of with the passions to an end a little sooner, although it is impossible to get to the end of it. And I left much of what you wrote during this time almost without a reply. You will find the answer to some things in what has been prescribed for you, and I will answer the other things now. You write that you have a lot of troubles around the house. Do everything you are told with diligence. This is your duty. But busy yourself. Do not be troubled. Troubles or cares are accompanied by agitation of everything within, and this is something that is not proper. Perhaps it is impossible to consider each errand calmly and then go do it, not in the least disturbed, with your thoughts collected. In everyday life, there is something hindering spiritual life. Then it is not an activity or occupation at all, but a vain, intricate care that gnaws at the heart and at the same time is not capable of advancing spiritual activity forward even by a hair. These arousals and stirring up the thoughts are like a whirlwind. A hubbub always results and spiritual activity gets nowhere at all. Distinguish, if you will, proper zeal from improper care and worries. And practice doing all activities soberly without deviating from the Lord in thought, but on the contrary, maintaining the conviction that you are pleasing him by all this. So he's not even at this point addressing the question of singing with her so much as it is her work around the home. If you remember, she lived at home with her folks at this point. And so much of her daily duty would have surrounded helping take care of the home, things like laundry or sewing, cooking. And his advice to her is very simple here, to engage in it as calmly as possible. And I think in our day, too, that would be true, whether one is a student or working in the world, to maintain a calm demeanor in one's labors can be very important. That often the frenetic pace of our culture, but even in the pace with which we work, can lead to an agitated heart and mind. And so establishing from the beginning, you know, am I engaging in my labors in such a way that I can maintain a certain level of reflectivity, that I'm not losing sight of God because I'm becoming so agitated or anxious about completing a task? And certainly there are jobs like that. And perhaps an individual has greater facility to engage in that work without becoming dissipated. And this is where I think we have to know ourselves well and choose a kind of labor that is going to be suitable to help us to engage in the spiritual life as deeply as we can. Because St. Theophan tells her that we can be engaging in a kind of labor and making our way through it day after day, but it can be so contrary to the spiritual life that we end up making no progress whatsoever, or perhaps even going backwards because we get so absorbed in those labors or the concerns that are tied to them that we never leave that state of agitation. And when we're in that state of agitation, prayer becomes an impossibility. And I think this is true even in regards to work within the church. We've spoken here often how, you know, life within the church can become very businesslike, and you know, program after program, moving from one thing to another. Often priests are, you know, pushed into these administrative roles for which they're not trained. You know, we're not trained accountants. We're not trained engineers to know how to fix air conditioning systems and things such as that, but nonetheless, or plumbers, but nonetheless, we sort of have to focus on those things, I think, too much of the time. I've plunged my share of toilets over these 30-some years, and they never taught us about that in seminary, that we would have to do those kind of things. So even in this work that is dedicated to religion, we don't want to fall into a kind of business or frenetic pace, or we're overly focused upon doing things that might be admired in the world, or are focused on numbers or progress, even in the sense of the world would look at it. And I think in many ways, the church has been drawn in that direction, and we end up ignoring maybe some more of the fundamental issues facing the church. And priests end up neglecting things such as divine liturgy or hearing confessions is a big thing. You know, it's sometimes people are hard fast to find confessions offered anywhere other than by appointment or 20 minutes. And so priests at times are moving away from what they are ordained for in order to attend to other things that seem to be important or they're told are important. And but nonetheless, getting back to what Theophan is telling Anastasia here, troubles are accompanied by agitation of everything within, and this is not something proper. So every errand that we have can become filled with that anxiety. And I think we can even get to that point where the agitation becomes so great, it becomes very difficult to break out of it, if that's the pattern of our life, and it has been for a long period of time. I think we can begin to start living in a constant state of agitation and become fearful about, you know, our progress, how well we're doing within the world or what we're achieving. And I think probably it's why people struggle, at least in part, with so much depression and anxiety. There is an enormous amount of pressure that culture puts upon us, and some things that we aren't even aware of. I think the constant noise that surrounds us too, that we rarely have moments of peace. There are a lot of homes that have the television on from first thing in the morning till late at night. If we're in the car, we're listening to music, work, constant noise, restaurants, often deafening noises. And so where is the silence within our life? And the stillness that allows deep prayer to emerge. And for the Christian, this is a habit of life, a way of life that we have to form and foster. And so if he's telling even someone like Anastasia, who's a young woman whose duties pretty much rest at home, and are even in a sense the work of her own hands. So potentially she could be engaged in a very deep sense of recollection in the midst of them. If he's telling her not to become agitated and try to engage in every errand, every task calmly, I can't imagine what he would tell us in our day in terms of what we need to jettison from our life to reestablish a humane pattern of living in terms of the length of our days and, again, the pace with which we work. The desert monks were very conscious of this and choosing on purpose a kind of labor, typically with their hands, so that they could remain recollected even as they were working. And certainly not all of us, and very few of us, might have the luxury of doing that. But they knew that to maintain this unceasing prayer, as well as the stillness of mind and heart, that the more that they could simplify their life, including how they supported themselves, the better. That they could maintain that constant remembrance of God. And so often they would make things to sell and take them to market, but otherwise they weren't engaging in that kind of labor, even scholarly, to such an extent that it would be a source of distraction for them. And I don't know if you remember the story from the Evagrius, that one of the monks is entrusted with writing down the sayings of the fathers, and he ends up not completing the task at all. And I think writes one thing down maybe to remind him of death, and so never produces what he told them he was going to do. Certainly we wouldn't get very far with that attitude now. But again, it shows us, I think, the different kind of mindset there. If only to shed a light on our own, you know, how is it that we're living our life from day to day? The hubbub, not a word that you typically hear in our day, but again, another one of those words worth saving. So remember this one, work it into your vocabulary, and I'll work it into my coming homilies. But always results, he says, in spiritual activity getting nowhere. Distinguish proper zeal from improper care and worries, and practice doing all activities soberly. So kind of a sober sobriety in what we do. So clarity of mind and purpose, and avoiding the hubbub. And so the constant noise around us, in order that we might not be filled with this constant care or worry. And, you know, I'm a natural born worrier. And so I take this advice very much to heart. And early on as a priest, very difficult for me, because, you know, this sense of responsibility of preaching or leading groups, you know, led to overwork. If you're a worrier, you overprepare. And so I overprepared, including homilies and things such as that. But there was some fruit to that, but not very much in the long run, other than giving me premature gray hair and aging me quickly. But so nonetheless, you know, be calm, focused in what you do from day to day. Now he's going to shift his focus a little bit here, but does anybody have any comments or questions about this, about work in general? Because you're all faced with this on a daily basis, at least I assume so. Eric, you work in a lab, right? How do you avoid the hubbub of day-to-day life? And go ahead.
The calm stuff. So I don't know. I mean, how do you think the conditions have changed with regards to his advice and practical applications today, you know? I mean, I guess for me, what I try to do is I just try to go to a secluded place in the building to just get my head, to get myself recollected, basically.
Right. Well, you know, I think every generation probably has had its own particular struggle. And I think for us as individuals, we would seek to make our desert would be our heart, that we would retreat to. And so through the practice of deep prayer and fostering silence at other times, that we would seek to maintain that throughout the course of our labors. And through that constant remembrance of God, be able to maintain that internal stillness, even if everything around us seems to be not just frenetic, but you know how things can become in offices and arguments can and tensions can begin to sort of predominate. And how is it then that one maintains that internal stillness unless you've cultivated it on a day-to-day basis, and that it goes beyond natural temperament? And I think that's sort of the important thing, that how does one live in a busy world unless by the grace of God, and that we begin to share in something of the peace of the kingdom and are able to carry that into our work with us. An interesting thing of the pandemic, I think, of what we've seen, if we want to just reflect upon that, that we did see a lot of people, I think, after being forced to work from home, began to find something very appealing about that, that it really did change the pace of their life and the dynamic of their day-to-day discussions, the connection with their own families. And so a lot of people chose to switch their jobs at that point, or to maintain working from the home, because I think they began to see that there was probably a lot that went along with working in an office that was more of a distraction than something that fostered clarity of purpose in one's work, even. I even felt the same thing about school. I thought, in large part, it was a pretty big waste of time. Time on the bus, that time that you make in homeroom, making your way from class to class, gym class, study halls, lunch. It's all a big waste of time. Most of us could have done the work in high school and half the time from home. And I think that's what a lot of homeschoolers began to realize too, that you could set about your work, get it done, and then move on to other things. And no, there might be some trade-offs there in terms of, the social life. But sometimes the social life isn't all that good. And anyone who's probably been bullied, either listening to this or here, probably knows that school is not often an easy place to exist. And so a lot of distractions there. And so I think people with this whole thing with the pandemic and staying at home, it changed them a little bit in terms of what they wanted for themselves long-term. When you slow things down, you begin to see life as a marathon and not the sprint, and that the sprint actually has, these costs tied to it, and that it's not all that valuable, perhaps not as valuable as we thought, then people began to make changes. So that's why I'm doing all my groups on Zoom now. It's much easier than having to walk downstairs. If I can just do it from my own room, it's great. So, Carl or Sawyer?
I was thinking of a thing I had heard a little while ago. I mean, and I guess it's in line with the Jesus prayer somewhat, but an abbot was talking about, the head of the abbey, was saying if he could make anyone a contemplative, if he would just have his men would stop like 8 times a day and just adore God for a minute every so often. And he said that the depth of contemplation and the fruits that bore just from that small act every day, like he said, within 2 years was just complete transformation.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think when we are living in the way that we are meant to live, especially in terms of that union and communion with God, and we begin to live in that peace of the kingdom, and we are breaking the day for prayer, then even the way that we engage in our work is going to change as well. That there's going to be a kind of clarity. It will bring less anxiety to those labors, and probably end up working through them with a greater speed. Not that that's the purpose of the spiritual life, but I think when you aren't working or laboring under anxiety or under fear, but with this clarity of purpose, where you see it as sort of a God-given, this is what God has placed before you at the moment, and you have that clarity entering into it, then even some of the things that come up as problems for us, we're going to be able to work our way through them with a greater ease. That anxiety and fear are enormous things, I think, for us to have to contain, and the energy devoted to containing those anxieties and fears is great. And so anything like that can pull away from our day-to-day labors. And so, you know, I think if somebody was running a company, the smart thing would be not only to give people, you know, breaks, but if the, you know, there was this opportunity, especially for the Christian company, of prayer, you know, that there were breaks in the day for that, it would make sense that it would be more like a monastery, you know, that they engage in their labor and then they break the day at various times in order to turn to God. And they're not so much focused on efficiency, but nonetheless, they engage in their work with a kind of zeal and clarity of purpose.
And I also think the gratitude, even thanking for the anxiety and the, whatever is coming up, but being grateful for what that is bringing forward in us and actively thanking God for that as that's coming up, I think kind of creates this internal shift that can really help us connect more to God. And it also reorients the whole experience, I think.
That's a good point, because I think, in that struggle with anxiety, when things like that come up, our life can become about managing our own anxiety. And we can hate it and hate ourselves for having it. And it can make life very difficult. Whereas, again, if we see that in the context of the relationship with God, and we might even see it as something that we struggle with and have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, but it no longer becomes something that shapes our identity. It's not who we are. It's something that we struggle with. Then there's kind of freedom that comes there. We might struggle with that anxiety on a day-to-day basis, but we can still engage in life and engage in that relationship with God, find meaning and purpose, even in the face of those things. And I think part of the problem in our day is that people are often defined or labeled or label themselves in certain ways. I have this or that, or, you know, I'm this or that. And if we could move away from that and see our identity tied to our being sons and daughters of God, then I think we would look at the things that we struggle with, and even our weaknesses, you know, the areas of poverty that we have, in a much different way, not as obstacles necessary to that relationship with God, but sometimes the very things that make us cling to Him all the more. And that's what I sort of mentioned earlier. You know, I was a worrier in the sense of performance, and so I would over prepare, and you think, gee, you know, I spent most of my life working, you know, but driven more by this internal drive to get rid of the anxiety than having this clarity of purpose about God. And there, that changes, you know, if you're a priest in particular, if you're preparing to preach or to lead a group, if that's the dynamic going on in your mind, it's going to make everything stilted. You know, you could be preaching about God, but if you're preaching about God and reading the scriptures through this lens of anxiety, oy. But the same is true, I think, in any work or in parenting. You know, if that's the lens through which we're viewing things, then it's going to distort our vision. So that's an excellent point. I'm glad that came up. Callie, or is it Lori? Is it? Okay.
It is, but it's me with the question.
Okay.
So I guess where I struggle is when you do get so caught up in the hubbub, mm-hmm. you know, of things.
Very and good.
Then how do you, and you know, you can't find yourself in deep prayer like you should be. How can you discern where you're supposed to go from there to find this, like what you're supposed to do to find your clarity of purpose? Like, how do you do that when you're in such a state of the hubbub?
Right. Well, I think, you know, all things begin and end with God. And so I think even with this kind of question, that we would turn to God first to help and guide us. I think when we see our life overtaken by certain realities and we feel the pressure of that, and that life, you know, loses, you know, this kind of quality to it where we're just driven and we move from day to day and time is just passing quickly, then, you know, we ask God to guide us and illuminate us, you know, to help us look at our lives with a kind of honesty, both in terms of what we desire and what God desires for us. And sometimes in seeing those things, we might come to the realization that there are some fundamental changes and maybe even sweeping changes that we would want to make in our life, which can be frightening to us because often we don't like change and we grow comfortable with the way that we've set our life. Even if it's hellish, it's our hell. And so we're familiar with it. We enter into our hell every single day. But if you were to ask us to step out of that hell, we'd fear encountering something, you know, unexpected. And so we jump back into our own hell. And that's what keeps people sort of paralyzed in where they are. And I think if we're able, with the grace of God, to look at our lives honestly and see them and the patterns that are there, the things that instill simplicity and make our lives frenetic or that create anxiety or depression, then we're able to look at our lives. We might not be able to change everything at once. And so I think taking that sort of off the table is an important thing, you know, not to be reactionary in our response, but rather honest. And making some of the changes that we want might take time, like moving toward a greater simplicity of life. It might mean setting certain things aside in order that something else more important to us, more valuable, might emerge. And having a clarity about what it is that we might set aside, what we might alter, might only come through prayer or seeking spiritual guidance in that regard. That it's hard, that, you know, we can't constantly in our life keep adding one thing after another. If we add some, we get to a point where if we add something, we have to remove something. Otherwise, our life becomes unlivable. I mean, it becomes oppressive to us and we will wear ourselves out. And so there has to be a certain level of discernment here that we're able to say, okay, you know, even though these things might be good or that there's part of me that loves them, I may need to cut them out of my life in order to have something that I see as being of greater value, that opens up the space that's necessary for me to have the kind of prayer life that I would want. And that might be certain social things that we participate in. It might be the job that we have and the amount of time that it demands. Maybe it pulls us, you know, maybe we're in it 18 hours a day or something like that. Or maybe it pulls us away from family life, things that have great meaning to us, or pulls us away from our relationship with God. And so there might be certain relationships too that I think bring more agitation to our lives or that are toxic and that we might find ourselves entwined in that we have to examine too. Don't get the wrong idea here. I'm not telling people to sort of jettison, you know, family members and friends from your lives, but sometimes there are relationships that are so toxic that they can really be very destructive for us on an emotional and spiritual level. And so there might be even things there that we would have to address to say, where do I need to reset the boundaries in my life in order that I can avoid the hubbub or the agitation and get back to a place where I can have some calmness and stability for myself and my family and things such as that. And I think there are, you know, many people have experienced jobs, work environments that are toxic. And eventually they have to just say, you know, I have to get out of this and go to someplace else where there's a something different operative, you know, in the way that they look at the people who work for them, what the ultimate goal is and how to get there. And some people lead with fear, you know, and they think that's the best way of motivating their workers, but it's not, and it's destructive, and certainly it's not going to lead to this kind of stillness and calmness that one would be seeking. So, you know, I think probably sitting down, even writing things down about one's life, examining all these different areas, and then to be able to look at it honestly, and the things that what is changeable, what is not, you know, what is essential, what is not, what allows us to engage in that relationship with God, what is an impediment to that. And even what kind of prayer is God calling me to? You know, where we step out of this way of approaching prayer as we would approach any other thing, in the sense of what I desire or what I think is good. You know, where God might lead us in the sense of the depth of our prayer life might make our life look a lot different than what it is now. You know, I think those living in the world are called to holiness of life. And what we read in the Fathers in terms of the, you know, ordering of one's life toward God, the struggle with the passions, dealing with one's thoughts, developing this deep prayer life, it's not just for those, you know, the monks did it in this radical way in stripping themselves of everything going into the desert. But what they lay before us is something for all. You know, we're all called to this intimacy with God. Within our particular station of life, we're called to pursue it. And so we can't, I think when we're making this kind of evaluation that you're asking, you know, we have to do what Theophan put before Anastasia right from the beginning. Everything is subordinate to God and to that relationship with him. And if we have that clear in our mind, that this is the most important thing for me as a human being, this is where I find my dignity, destiny. This is what's going to shape my life. And if I get married, this is what's going to shape my marriage. If I have children, this is what's going to shape the kind of parent I am. And so everything becomes subordinate to that, and the kind of work that I do as well is subordinated to that reality. And I think I've mentioned here before, I've had people over time ask, you know, I have this opportunity to take this great job on an oil rig, you know, where I'm going to be out in the middle of the ocean for 6 months or a year, but I'm not going to be able to get to Mass or confession that whole time. But I'm going to make great money. I'm going to make loads of money. And it's a great opportunity. And, you know, I think a person would have to, in conscience, to look at that and say, you know, what is that going to do for my relationship with God? What would that mean to me to separate myself from the sacraments for that length of a period of time? Is there a certain amount of money that makes that warranted? Or would I say, no, you know, that's too great of a cost. And I think even in terms of the, you know, when we begin college studies and we begin thinking about, you know, careers, that should be at the forefront of our mind too. That, you know, what is that work going to entail? You know, I might be very attracted to that, but how is it going to shape my life? Is it going to leave space for maybe the greater things I desire, family life, children? But most importantly, is it going to allow that room for me to have a relationship with God? Or is it going to crowd out that relationship altogether? So I know that's sort of a long and rambly response to your question, but I don't want to oversimplify it either, because I think it does require from us, you know, a kind of mature way of looking at our life in the context of this relationship with God, and then how we allow them to take shape, and how we allow that relationship then to guide the decisions that we make about our life. Okay. Eric Chastain, you had a follow up?
Yeah, actually, I read something earlier today that I thought was applicable. It's about one of the monks who is a desert father. And at the time, actually, they actually didn't pray that much in a non-working capacity. So they were working very actively. And actually, this is kind of like a hard situation because the monk was a calligrapher. So he had to think a lot, right, to do that. And so I thought it was applicable. So this is describing his mental state. It's by another monk. Let us recall that Evagrius was a hermit in a monastic center in the Egyptian desert who died in 399. He maintained a very meager diet and drank very little water. He did not drink coffee. His whole life was centered around prayer. He did not have a television, a camcorder, or a video player, a regular or mobile telephone, a computer with an internet connection, a fax machine, a tape or disc recorder to record services on weekends, newspapers, magazines, automobiles, or electricity. He read some books, among them scripture, which he had as a book form. He calligraphed, I guess, scripture for a living. His stream of mental representations might have been somewhat different from yours or mine. That stream was certainly slower, and much more focused than yours or mine. So they occurred so slowly that Evagrius will later assert that we can have only one mental representation at a time. And it must leave before another one can come. So it's all of this kind of, these are all lifestyle factors. And also, as you're saying, centering one's life on God and on God alone.
Yeah, they weren't big on multitasking.
No. And that slowed it down so strongly for him. Right. And I mean, also humbling the body and everything.
Right. Well, think about books and their development too. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past about how that was tied to the practice of Lectio Divina, you know, this prayerful contemplative reading of the scriptures or of some other religious book. And part of the reason for that slow reading is that they would often memorize texts, sometimes the entire New Testament, and because they knew the value of a book, and they would only have it for a certain amount of time before they would have to pass it on to somebody else. They didn't have this instant access to the constant flow of information that we have today. So it did create this different pace in their day-to-day life, but also in the way that one would think, in the way that one would pray. And so we might actually begin praying in the way that we work. If this is the habit of mind and the habit of behaviors, so we're working at this really quick pace to get through as many projects as we can or tasks as we can, then we could approach the prayer life in a similar way. You know, doing the rosary in 10 minutes, you know, get through all those Hail Marys as quickly as one can, or the prayer rope, you know, say 1,000 Jesus prayers, you know, within a half an hour or something along those lines. And so we have to be careful about this. We hear these stories even from the desert monks where a very holy soul would see another monk working. And every once in a while, the monk would tell himself, well, if I worked harder today, I could, you know, get more done, chop more wood, and I'll have this greater supply for later for myself. And the monk who was holy could see the demon behind him sort of whipping him, you know, moving him to work at this harder and harder pace in order that his work, that labor would become the focal point of his attention, that became the thing that was most important. and working beyond what was needed for that particular day. And think about all of us, you know, even I think about it, you know, it's like, I can't stand to be without a month at a view calendar where I can't see everything that's coming and plan out for it. And again, part of that is being driven by a kind of anxiety, but also this sense of not allowing anything to fall through the cracks, and where the work and the labor becomes the main point of focus. But we aren't as inclined to block off a couple hours of prayer, you know, to, you know, engage in that relationship with God. You know, it's squeezed in often after the task of the day, or squeezed in, you know, before the task of the day, rather than being something that shapes our reality and our experience of reality. And so, you know, sometimes these asides turn out to be the most important thing to discuss, you know, or to explore, because it does make us think about our life in a little bit of a deeper way. I have one of these watches now, a Fitbit. Has anybody heard of those? It drives me nuts because it has this, it tells you when you get a message. You know, somebody sends you a text or something like that. And so, you know, if you're a prayer or whatever, you feel your wrist, you know, buzz. And not that I couldn't turn that off, but I keep it on for some reason, as if I need, because there's this pressure to know if somebody's trying to get a hold of you. And the best thing I could do is probably take it off and stomp on it. And, you know, I put on my old Timex. But there is this sense of one has of needing to know and to respond to things immediately, or else you're doing something wrong. That if spacing out time for yourself, let alone yourself in that relationship with God, can become more and more problematic. Okay, we're going to move on. All right. So he begins to speak to her now a little bit about music, singing and playing, which she was inclined to do and found great joy in doing. But questions came up for her, you know, about what would be appropriate in this regard. You ask, how should one be with regard to singing and playing on the piano and the harmonium? Does anybody know what a harmonium is by chance? I didn't have a chance to look it up. Okay. So, I used to sing and play without paying attention to the content of the pieces, and now it is on my mind. As you certainly know, not all pieces have good content, although they may have a nice melody. What should you do? It is impossible for you to change everything at once. This is immediately obvious. Sing and play as you used to, trying not to pay attention to the content. In the meantime, start selecting songs with good or perhaps just tolerable content and sing and play these more until finally you completely forget the others that make up your singing and playing. The harmonium is very capable of expressing church hymns in the necessary manner. Get the compositions of Turchaninov and learn the ones you like best. So this is where culture and time sort of affects. I don't know who Turchaninov is either. Perhaps I should. But so it's sort of interesting. You know, he begins to talk to her about the kind of content that she's been exposed to over time in the music and what she selected and how deeply that becomes etched in the memory and imagination. And, you know, songs in particular come back to mind with great ease. And you've probably all had the experience of an earworm. Have you ever heard that term? Where somebody starts singing some song and then you get it stuck in your mind for the rest of the day. And even if it's a song you hate, you find yourself sort of humming this. And Father Stephen tonight was talking about that old group is coming out with a new album, ABBA. Remember that old group back from the, like the, what was it, the 80s or 70s? And, you know, they're like in their 70s now, between 70 and 79. And they're coming out with this new album. But, you know, God help you if you get one of their songs stuck in your mind, because then that's what you're carrying around with you throughout the course of the day. And, you know, so I don't think, you know, obviously we can point to things in our culture about music that is problematic, which is obvious to us, you know, that there is, you know, vulgar, explicit lyrics, things that are demeaning to people as human beings that obviously as a Christian man or woman, we would want to avoid. But there are also things that can fill our minds that have a certain, you know, melody to them and that do get stuck in the mind. And, but perhaps carry the mind off, you know, into this, its own kind of daydream. And it becomes a source of distraction in that regard, that it's not necessarily elevating the mind and the heart to God, but it can become sort of a narcissistic kind of thing, that we become absorbed in it in such a way that it is disconnected and disconnects us from God. And that might seem to be a little bit of a harsh way of looking at things, but I think when we do step back and think, even what I've mentioned about the earworm, that it is possible to get something etched in one's mind where immediately when, you know, we are walking down the street or whatever, instead of the mind turning to God or this constant remembrance of God that Theophan emphasizes is so important, that this is really our foothold to intimacy with God, instead of that prayer coming to mind, what we have coming into our mind is this very familiar song. And think about it for a moment. When people get into the car, often the first thing that they do is turn on the radio. And you hear the same things over and over again. Workplaces often have the radio going on too. And so there's this constant influx of music of all different sorts filling the air. And I think what Theophan would have Anastasia, as well as us, understand is that it's not as though that has no meaning or no impact upon us, that it can be relatively benign even, and yet become for us something that we are filling the mind with and that takes hold of our attention, that captivates us. And I think that's why he draws her attention to these certain kinds of melody, but that's what they do. They captivate the mind, you know, that they're of a certain nature that our minds keep going back to them over and over again as a way of self-entertainment, you know, as it were. You know, we can lose ourselves in them very easily rather than being attentive to God. And again, I think this is something that's pretty challenging for us to say, you know, are things in our life subordinated to God? And I'm not a big fan of the word subordinated, but I think, you know, is everything in our life, does everything in our life take its meaning from our relationship with God, you know, in terms of everything that we experience? And does it begin and end with him? Does it shape the way that we view the world and that we view others, and even the way that we view music or entertainment? And I think this is what Theophan is saying, yes, that's what it should be, that our relationship should be of such a nature that it begins to shape everything that we do. And if what we're doing isn't in conformity with that, then we need to look at it closely. Is it something that ultimately that's going to lead us away, if only in subtle ways over time? You know, first becoming a distraction, then giving certain rise to certain thoughts, feelings. You know, there's certain kinds of music that sort of, again, captivate us because of their nature. And we'll do that to such an extent that we are drawn into it. I mean, I have to imagine that's why people love going to dance clubs and things like that. The music is so loud and that it sort of takes hold of people. And, you know, you next thing you know, there are a couple hundred people jumping around like fools in a room. No, just kidding. I don't want to be harsh. But you know, that's what sort of takes place. And one could say that equally, you know, about anything else. Like, look at a football game. You know, it's like you have a stadium filled with 75,000 people all screaming, you know, with watching guys run up and down the field with, you know, a football or kicking a soccer ball. You know, there's not much difference there. In fact, football takes over Sundays mostly, so I suppose that's more of a problem because of the Sabbath day. So anything so far on what? Oh, Carl.
So I'll just say I was, I used to be a musician, so music was, you know, certainly an important thing for me, and is, but I converted about 11 years ago. And after I converted, I noticed slowly that my ability to listen to and enjoy certain kind of music changed. And there was some obvious thing. I won't bore you with the sort of shocking sorts of rock and roll that I stopped being able to listen to and enjoy. But I was a classical musician. And what was interesting is that even sort of the classical things, in a lot of ways, it was harder in a lot of ways to enjoy that in sort of a casual way. You know, so if you put on your nice big romantic symphony, right, like that is something that is intentionally causing these a strong emotional response. I mean, that's what a romantic symphony is for, in a way. That's the goal of these things. And to some extent, like, it felt like sort of, you know, again, after my conversion and as I, you know, deepened the prayer life, it felt like a lot of times this was going in and it was just sort of tweaking me emotionally. And it felt like, why? Like, why is this, why am I letting this happen? What is this doing? And I, you know, enjoyed it much less often and kind of pulled away from it. And I think it was sort of like a natural response of what Theophan is talking about here, which is to not allow these things to take up so much space to some extent, you know. And I think what you're getting at here is to acknowledge the enormous power that music can have, and to not allow that to kind of take over. And the last thing I'll say is that one of the things that I did when I was a musician is I would play in these mega churches, these sort of big evangelical mega churches. And a lot of those services are centered around music, and it's used for that sort of emotional response. And I mean, people have such strong feelings about how music is used in the church, but I'll say in those settings, it was primarily emotional, right? It wasn't worshipful. It was missing solemnity to me, right? And I think that's part of what he's getting at here, the danger in these things.
That's right. Yeah. And we don't want to demonize music because, as you said, we know the power of it. And the power that it can have over the human heart. And there's this affective part of our spiritual life too. And that music can elevate us, you know, in that sense. And so I think what he's trying to encourage her is to be discriminating and to be able to see that, how that is true. And you're right. You know, I have a friend here in Pittsburgh who's a guitarist, and he plays at one of those mega churches too. And as a guitarist, he loves it because it gives him this freedom to play play his guitar in the way that he loves, even the electric guitar too. And, but, you know, clearly he's Catholic, certainly. And so he can clearly sort of see some of the same things that you mentioned there, that its appeal is because it does speak to that affective level. And that is a big part of the nature of the worship there. And I think, but when we do look at the fullness of the tradition, that there is a kind of sobriety and solemnity about that music that is very much connected to what it is that we're praying and what it is that we're believing, but also what is taking place in that worship, in particular, the sacrifice of the Mass. And so there is an effective element, but it's seen within the larger context of our of what God has revealed of himself to us and our understanding of ourselves as human beings. And often, I think there has been such a breakdown of the understanding of the nature of the church, and there are so many differences in even understanding of worship itself that making those distinctions becomes very difficult. But certainly Theophan would have understood that and understood the importance for Anastasia over the course of her life, that as one who's musically inclined and loved it, that he would have to offer her some counsel here, because she was already seeing that there was something about it that enough to make her question. There was something about it that's, you know, what should I be exposing myself to here? What should I be playing and singing? I'm going to go to Mary McLeod. Okay, Eric, just because, just to give another person a chance here. Okay, here. Mary.
Yeah, I think a lot of us who are converts had to at some point look at the music that we're listening to and say, oh, okay, I guess I can't listen to them anymore. I can't listen to this because it is so powerful. Several years later after my conversion, actually, I wasn't listening to anything where the lyrics were morally problematic or whatever, but it was in a time where I was engaged in a lot of very intense spiritual battles. And a friend of mine who majored in music was talking to me about it, that, you know, it's even if the lyrics aren't overtly problematic, it affects the human person so much that, you know, you have to pay attention to what it does to your heart at a very deep level, because it does affect us so deeply. Like, for example, in the Old Testament, you know, there is that instance where David at the time, before he was king, would play music and the demons would leave King Saul, you know, and there's music is that powerful. Or in heaven, you know, there's like the Song of Heaven. And it's part of our liturgies. And, you know, there's something so deeply affecting for us that even if we can't, you know, tell on a mental level that something is affecting us or leading us away from God in a certain way, you know, to really pray through what we listen to. I personally just don't aesthetically like praise and worship music. It's just not my thing. But I did discover there are actually a lot of different types of genres of Christian music. So there's like, I even found these old pieces from like the 1920s, these black pastors singing these like gospel tunes that were really interesting. But anyway, so just reflecting on how, and it's not even just the age, like he was saying, where classical music, like one of Mozart's favorite, most famous arias is like super, super dark. And it's about a witch who's like cursing, you know, these, this woman or whatever. And it's just, it doesn't matter, if it's from the 1800s, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to.
Right. That it's going to be fruitful. Right. Right. You there, Mary? I think she might've got cut off. But, you know, I think what she was saying was certainly spot on, that, and we don't, again, want to demonize music here. I think it's part of the patristic psychology and anthropology, you know, that we've talked about so many times. We're in this constant state of receptivity. And this understanding of who we are as human beings has to be taken into consideration. And there is a kind of discrimination that we have to engage in that shows that we have a kind of awareness about how all of these things do affect us on a day-to-day basis, the thoughts that we have, the things that we're exposed to, and the music that we hear. We know that there's only one good music, and that's the Russian choral music, you know. That's what, you know, that's really speaks to the heart and the soul. Everything else is just, you know. But I think he's pretty balanced here with her, you know, because and this is what impresses me, that, you know, he's not being harsh with her, nor is he telling her to, like, step away from everything right away. You know, he knows that that's impossible and that that wouldn't even be healthy for her, that she would be cutting out something from her life that is very human, but also that elevates the soul. And that her movement here, she wants to be guided by, have it guided by prayer and to be thoughtful and not just, again, sort of demonizing music to such an extent then that she loses something from her life. And so she can continue to play those songs until she starts listening to Russian choral music, and then everything will be fine. But until then, she can continue to listen to it. But that brings us to 8:30. I thought we would get through this letter. But we made it through a couple paragraphs anyways. But next time, I'm sure we'll get through this letter. But he'll be going on, you know, through this last little bit with her. And then he's going to start looking at, you know, solitude, again, its importance, and then take her on to look at the specific writings of Abba Poimen, or Poimen, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, and then St. Sergius, and their reflections upon some of the things that he's been writing about. But it's a beautiful thing. I mean, he doesn't neglect anything from her life and or that she asked about in terms of how it might have an impact upon her spiritual life. So we'll pick up here next time. So if you have any thoughts about music, you know, bring them for the next time as well. We don't want to be criticizing too many forms of music here, because I know that some of that music has spoken to people. I came into the church when it was only glory and praise music. So my first experience of the church was sort of schizophrenic, glory and praise or Gregorian chant. Finally, I eventually made the shift over. You know, my schizophrenia left me and I became clear-headed. All right. Thank you all. And we'll close as always with the Our Father. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
And Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.